We're dealing with chapter 22 right now, Beyond the Modes of Nature, originally called Beyond the Gunas, when it was first published on the 15th of May, 1918. The nature of the self. This is, of course, the big challenge to Arjuna, who is confronted with what he seems to be seized with as an experience of his limitations, of the inadequacy of his teaching, the foundering of the whole culture in which he finds himself. And so to move from the quaking ego to the surety of the self is one of the steps that he has to take as an instrument of the divine acting in the world and illuminated from within. It isn't that the ego is an enemy per se. We see in the Sankhya Yoga, which is a tradition that comes into being actually after the Gita is composed. But in the philosophy of the Sankhya, the ego is an appearance driven by nature of a point of awareness of individuality. In a field of relative darkness comes this sense of self, this ego sense. It is a mechanical thing driven by nature, surely, but it reflects a truth of the deeper spirit within. It isn't that the ego is the truth, but the ego is also not a lie. The ego is a developmental entity to massage into the universe the possibility of individuality. Sri Aurobindo in The Life Divine has written... excuse me. Sri Aurobindo has written in The Life Divine about the inevitability of the ego's manifestation in the universe. How else would the universe become aware of all of its possibilities? Remember, the three terms of existence which appear in that great book, in the Synthesis of Yoga, and which have made frequent appearances here in Essays on the Gita also, this triplicity of being, that there is a transcendent which manifests, makes itself expressed in cosmic form and also in individual form. Well, the universal creation is what we call prakriti in the Sankhya. But within the field of prakriti, the ahankara, the I-maker, has to come into being as well. So it is a necessary stage of development, as Sri Aurobindo writes elsewhere. Ego is the helper, ego is the bar. You cannot transcend the ego until you have one. You're perfectly welcome to leap beyond, but to get beyond the ego is imperative for the seeker. But one cannot get beyond the self. The self is the essence both of cosmos and of individuality, and is the essence of the Supreme Being itself, himself, herself. So we want to know what we are so that we can act truly in the world. And along the way, we're perfectly free to shed egoism and then ultimately ego. If you want to look into the deep chapters on this in The Life Divine, obviously, in Book 1, Chapter 7, The Ego and the Dualities, And then in Book 2, Part 1 of The Life Divine, Chapter 9, Memory, Ego, and Self-Experience. Have a look at those, but also Chapter 17 in that second book, God, Man, and Nature, makes it clear that it is necessary to find one's individuality first before moving to the larger picture of things. We have engaged in a vast yoga, in the integral yoga scheme of things, wherein we don't simply want to change ourselves and live from within, live from the truth of our own being, but we want to see that manifest broadly. We want to see our own being live in harmony with others, and that the all of us would live in harmony with the nature that we inhabit. It's not other than us, and it's not a commodity, and we should be able to live in accord with it, in concord with it, in harmony with it. And we all will sing individual notes, and it will form a harmony, but all the notes will be sung as part of a single song, yes? It's a cosmic song. So the sooner that we can get to our own truth, the sooner we can join that soulful choir, if I may. I'm not trying to be preachy or religious here, but I'm just saying that we can and should do better socially and personally. We can transform self and society, but it has to be based on something other than the ratiocinative mind. We can't figure this out intellectually. We can't wrestle with the ego and subdue it, but we can, following a sunlit path, move one step after another into deep felicity and find the substance of our soul and live from that. And so why don't we? Why don't we? Well, the problem for dear Arjuna on the field of Kurukshetra is that he has to grasp this almost immediately. He has to leap from one stage of being to another. And so this is a big challenge. It's a challenge to grasp these concepts, even if he's been studying about the nature of Purusha and Prakriti, to suddenly begin to live from Purusha and not from Ahankara, not from the ego, but from the deeper self. That's all in front of him, and he can't effectively join battle until he's done that. So this is the crux of the problem for him. This is the real crucible, and he must emerge from it successfully to save the nation and to sustain Sanatana Dharma. It's huge, but he's the man for the job. He's the soul for the job. So let's pick up Sri Aurobindo's essay, where we were. And here he's speaking about the poise of the soul, its complicated relationship with the universe around, with the play of nature, with the nature of self, the self in nature advances as the ego, and above the nature, the self finds itself to be serene and eternal and unblemished by anything moving in time. So the one that is advancing in nature is the mutable, the changing self. That's the Kshara Purusha. And the one above, always eternal, always free, immaculate in being, ever peaceful, that poise is the Akshara Purusha, that which doesn't change. So having refreshed ourselves with that vocabulary, let's begin. For beyond the soul, manifest in nature and bound up with its action, is another status of the Purusha. which is entirely a status and not at all an action. That is the silent, the immutable, the all-pervading, self-existent, motionless self, Sarvagatam Achalam. And for comparison, you can look at 2:24. Not exactly the words used there, but Sarvagatam, all-pervading, universal in being, unmoving, motionless, Achalam. Immutable being and not becoming, the Akshara. In the Kshara, the soul is involved in the action of nature. Therefore, it is concentrated, loses itself, as it were, in the moments of time, in the waves of the becoming. Not really, but only in appearance and by following the current. In the Akshara, nature falls to silence and rest in the soul. Therefore, it becomes aware of its immutable being. The Kshara is the Sankhya's Purusha when it reflects the varied workings of the gunas of nature, and it knows itself as the Saguna, the personal. The Akshara is the Sankhya's Purusha when these gunas have fallen into a state of equilibrium, and it knows itself as the Nirguna, the impersonal. Therefore, while the Kshara, associating itself with the work of Prakriti, seems to be the doer of works, Karta, the Akshara, dissociated from all the workings of the gunas, is the inactive non-doer, Akarta, and witness. 4:13. The soul of man, when it takes the poise of the Kshara, identifies itself with the play of personality and readily clouds its self-knowledge with the ego sense in nature, so that he thinks of himself as the ego doer of works. When it takes its poise in the Akshara, it identifies itself with the impersonal and is aware of nature as the doer and itself as the inactive witnessing self, Akartaram. The mind of man has to tend to one of these poises. It takes them as alternatives. It is bound by nature to action in the mutations of quality and personality, or it is free from her workings in immutable impersonality. So you're either engrossed in the machinery of nature, thinking you're doing things, wrestling, striving, etc., or you're utterly free of it, and nature stands before you somewhere, but you're not identified with it, and so you're free in eternity. The Kshara Purusha is part of time. The Akshara Purusha is beyond time. So these two poises of the soul, really, is that all? Sri Aurobindo continues. But these two, the status and immutability of the soul, and the action of the soul and its mutability in nature, actually coexist. And this would be an anomaly, irreconcilable except by some such theory as that of Maya, or else of a double and divided being, if there were not a supreme reality of the soul's existence, of which these are the two contrary aspects, but which is limited by neither of them. We have seen that the Gita finds this in the Purushottama. The Supreme Soul is the Ishvara, God, the Master of all being, Sarvaloka Maheshwara. He puts forth his own active nature, his Prakriti, Svam Prakritim, says the Gita, manifest in the Jiva, worked out by the Svabhava own becoming of each jiva according to the law of the divine being in it, the great lines of which each jiva must follow, but worked out too in the egoistic nature by the bewildering play of the three gunas upon each other, guna guneshu vartante. So this is a whole group of shlokas here, 529, 911, 98, and 83. This is an extremely important connection that Sri Aurobindo is joining here with all of these shlokas. And so, to 9.8, Prakritim Svam Avashtabhya, having animated my own nature in English. So the Supreme Being claims Prakriti as his own, not something different and outside. Remember how theism works. In Western theology, God is so perfect that he creates a world outside himself, and there's the world, it's full of defects, etc., even though God created it, can't be identified with God. They are different realities. But this teaching of Vedanta in the Gita says that the Supreme Being manifests, animates, breathes life into, stirs into activity his own nature. Prakriti belongs to him. It's part of his being, not different. So we have to account for that somehow. And then we go to 8.3, where we fix ourselves on the idea of the swabhava of the jiva. The jiva is that eternal self above who enters somehow into the space and time and manifests there using the truth of his own nature, its own nature, her own nature, swabhava, own becoming. And it articulates eternity as immortality in the process of time. So this is the truth behind your being. Then there is a more active front, which is the swadharma, the way, the law of your being that expresses the swabhava, which expresses the eternity of the individual above, always one with the purushottama. So you see the great chain of being reaching down into nature, never absent for a second, but unseen. And we don't make the connection until we evolve and grow enough to be ready to recognize it. So back to Sri Aurobindo's paragraph here. And he's about to make a further point. That is the Trigunya Mayi Maya, the Maya hard for man to get beyond, Duratyaya. This is 328 and 714. Yet one can get beyond it by transcending the three gunas. For while all this is done by the Ishvara, through his nature power in the Kshara, in the Akshara, he is untouched, indifferent, regarding all equally, extended within all, yet above all. So this is an interesting poise of the self, because it is above, it transcends, it's above the line of manifestation, not equated with the activity of Prakriti, extended within it, so it is immanent. Universal. Everything is drenched in its being. And yet above all. In all three, he is the Lord, the Supreme Ishvara in the highest, the presiding and all-pervading impersonality, Prabhu and Vibhu, in the Akshara and the immanent will and present active Lord in the Kshara. So go to 9:18 and 5:15 for those supporting verses. He is free in his impersonality, even while working out the play of his personality. He is not either merely impersonal or personal, but one and the same being in two aspects. He is the impersonal personal, nirguno guni, of the Upanishad. By him, all has been willed even before it is worked out. As he says of the still living Dhartharashtrians, already have they been slain by me. Maya nihata purvam eva. That's 11:33. And the working out by nature is only the result of his will. Yet, by virtue of his impersonality behind, he is not bound by his works. Kartaram akartaram. And that's 4:13. So at one and the same time, he is a supreme being that holds within the vastness, within the silence of his eternity, that oceanic being of Brahman, all things. All things manifest out of there. Nature manifests out of that. Para-prakriti is above that, part of the Supreme's supreme nature. Yes, and Brahman is an expression of its being. In that unexpressed eternity comes the expression, the manifestation, and that is Prakriti. So Para-prakriti gives birth to Prakriti. And the will in Para-prakriti, whose belongs only to the Purushottama, expresses itself in every instance, every circumstance, in all beings who populate this, our moving universe. So, if that strikes wonder or terror into the mind and the heart, what to do? But man, as the individual self, owing to his ignorant self-identification with the work and the becoming, as if that were all his soul and not a power of his soul, a power proceeding from it, is bewildered by the ego sense. He thinks that it is he and others who are doing all. He does not see that nature is doing all, and that he is misrepresenting and disfiguring her works to himself by ignorance and attachment. He is enslaved by the gunas, now hampered in the dull case of tamas, now blown by the strong winds of rajas, now limited by the partial lights of sattva, not distinguishing himself at all from the nature mind, which alone is thus modified by the gunas. He is therefore mastered by pain and pleasure, happiness and grief, desire and passion, attachment and disgust. He has no freedom. Huh. Live in the ego, you're trapped in determinism. You're trapped according to the nature of the obvious nature outside. He must, to be free, get back from the nature action to the status of the akshara. He will then be trigunatita, beyond the gunas, knowing himself as the akshara Brahman, the unchanging Purusha. He will know himself as an immutable impersonal self, the Atman, tranquilly observing and impartially supporting the action, but himself calm, indifferent, untouched, motionless, pure, one with all beings in their self, not one with nature and her workings. This self, though by its presence authorizing the works of nature, though by its all-pervading existence supporting and consenting to them, Prabhu Vibhu, does not itself create works, or the state of the doer, or the joining of the works to their fruit, na kartrutvam na karmani srijati na karma pala samyoga. 5.14 through 5.15. But only watches nature in the kshara, working out these things. Swabhavas tu pravartate. And that's continuation of 5.14. It accepts neither the sin nor the virtue of the living creatures born into this birth as its own. Nadate kasyachit papam nachayvam sukritam. 5.15. It preserves its spiritual purity. It is the ego, bewildered by ignorance, which attributes these things to itself, because it assumes the responsibility of the doer and chooses to figure as that and not as the instrument of a greater power, which is all that it really is. Agnyanevavrittam jnanam tena muhyante jantava. By going back into the impersonal self, the soul gets back into a greater self-knowledge and is liberated from the bondage of the works of nature, untouched by her gunas, free from her shows of good and evil, suffering and happiness. The natural being, the mind, body, life, still remain, nature still works, but the inner being does not identify himself with these, nor, while the gunas play in the natural being, does he rejoice or grieve. He is the calm and free, immutable self, observing all. So one can rise out of identification with the moving nature and the wrong sense that you're creating and doing the work when really nature is doing it through you. And in having risen, you can seat yourself in the great, white, vast, auspicious purity of the sheer self. Is this the last state, the utmost possibility, the highest secret? It cannot be, since this is a mixed or divided, not a perfectly harmonized status, a double, not a unified being, a freedom in the soul, an imperfection in the nature. It can only be a stage. That is, where the kshara purusha is identified with the work and the ego, and the eternal being above is aware of itself with a capital S. It can only be a stage. What then is there beyond it? One solution is that of the sannyasin who rejects the nature, the action altogether, so far at least as action can be rejected, so that there may be an unmixed, undivided freedom. But this solution, though admitted, is not preferred by the Gita. The Gita also insists on the giving up of actions, sarva karmani sannyasya, but inwardly to the Brahman. Brahman, in the kshara, supports wholly the action of prakriti. Brahman, in the akshara, even while supporting it, dissociates itself from the action, preserves its freedom. The individual soul, unified with the Brahman in the akshara, is free and dissociated, yet unified with the Brahman in the kshara, supports but is not affected. This it can do best when it sees that both are aspects of the one Purushottama. It is that third poise of the Purusha, which is the solution to existence which the Gita offers. And by the way, if you're looking for the citations above, that was 513 and 330. The Purushottama, inhabiting all existences as the secret Ishvara, controls the nature, and by his will, now no longer distorted and disfigured by the ego sense, the nature works out the actions by the Swabhava. The individual soul makes the divinized natural being an instrument of the divine will, nimitta matram. That's 1133. So there we go. We get back when we rise to the freedom of the akshara and then rise again into the nature of the Purushottama to identify with the Supreme, find the key to our own true individuality, and can then, in union with the divine will, express that divine will through our individual nature, Swabhava. Ha! It is the solution to life that we seek. He remains, even in action, Trigunatita, beyond the gunas, free from the gunas, Nistraigunya. He fulfills entirely at last the early injunction of the Gita, Nistraigunyo Bhavarjana. That's at 245. He is indeed still the enjoyer of the gunas, as is the Brahman, though not limited by them. Nirgunam guna boktra cha, pardon me, unattached, yet all-supporting, even as is that Brahman, asaktam sarva-brit. But the action of the gunas within him is quite changed. It is lifted above their egoistic character and reactions. So, chapter 13, shlokas 14 and 15 there. Four, he has unified his whole being in the Purushottama, has assumed the divine being and the higher divine nature of becoming, Madbhava, my nature, has unified even his mind and natural consciousness with the divine, Manmanna Machitta. So this is one of the closing shlokas in the Gita, 1865. And again, Madbhava 934, Manmana Machittaha 1857 and 58. So again, very close to the end of the poem. This change is the final evolution of the nature and the consummation of the divine birth, Rahasyam Uttamam. That's 4.3. When it is accomplished, the soul is aware of itself as the master of its nature and, grown a light of the divine light and will of the divine will, is able to change its natural workings into a divine action. So this leads us to free action in the world, no longer bound by karma, in which we become an agent of the divine will and change the very functioning of nature. It becomes free from slavery to the machinery driven by the wheel of karma and can express more directly the will of the Supreme. That leads to the possibility of transformation. It is indeed a transformation of the nature, a radical change that Arjuna undertakes on the field of Kurukshetra, led by Krishna to this light. Greater transformations are possible, and this is where Sri Aurobindo comes in, roughly a century ago, and proclaims to us what new world may be if we are willing to undertake self-change. First find the soul, live in the universal self, and then call down a radiant light from above and beyond into this field of comparative darkness. Yes, there is divinity sleeping here. Let's wake it up. So that's the end of this chapter. Let me note that next chapter, 23, is Nirvana and works in the world, and we'll find that Nirvana is not a cessation of life to the Gita or to Sri Aurobindo, but an opening towards a greater and divine life. There are 24 chapters, so if we begin 23 next week, you can see that we're coming to the end of the first series in Essays on the Gita. And when we have completed it, we're going to take up Sri Aurobindo's small but magnificent book, The Mother, and spend weeks in it, talking about it and the entire themes that are articulated within its pages. I thought we could read from Savitri tonight in closing, from Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release, and we're towards the bottom of page 39. Oceans of being met his voyaging soul, calling to infinite discovery. Timeless domains of joy and absolute power stretched out, surrounded by the eternal hush. The ways that lead to endless happiness ran like dream smiles through meditating vasts. Disclosed, stood up in a gold moment's blaze, white sunsteps in the pathless infinite. Along a naked curve in bornless self, the points that run through the closed heart of things shadowed the indeterminable line that carries the everlasting through the years. The magician order of the cosmic mind, coercing the freedom of infinity with a stark array of nature's symbol facts and life's incessant signals of event, transmuted chance recurrences into laws, a chaos of signs into a universe. Out of the rich wonders and the intricate whorls of the spirits dance with matter as its mask, the balance of the world's design grew clear, its symmetry of self-arranged effects managed in the deep perspectives of the soul, and the realism of its elusive art, its logic of infinite intelligence, its magic of a changing eternity. A glimpse was caught of things forever unknown. The letters stood out of the unmoving word. In the immutable nameless origin was seen emerging as from fathomless seas the trail of the ideas that made the world, and sown in the black earth of nature's trance, the seed of the spirit's blind and huge desire, from which the tree of cosmos was conceived and spread its magic arms through a dream of space. Immense realities took on a shape. There looked out from the shadow of the unknown, the bodiless namelessness that saw God born, and tries to gain from the mortal's mind and soul a deathless body and a divine name. The immobile lips, the great surreal wings, the visage masked by superconscient sleep, the eyes with their closed lids that see all things, appeared of the architect who builds in trance. The original desire born in the void peered out. He saw the hope that never sleeps, the feet that run behind a fleeting fate, the ineffable meaning of the endless dream. hardly for a moment glimpsed, viewless to mind, as if a torch held by a power of God, the radiant world of the everlasting truth glimmered like a faint star bordering the night above the golden overmind's shimmering ridge. Namaste. Jai Ma.